Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to Arguing History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Master Historian Professor Jeremy Black. Professor Black is Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Exeter, and today we're discussing the topic of Her Royal Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, her life and reign. Welcome, Professor Black.
Hello.
Professor, what is your earliest memory of the late Queen?
That's an interesting one. Actually, funnily enough, she just was there, as it were, by osmosis. But what I can tell you is what happened with my son. In 1990, my son, then a little boy of three, was faced with the fact that the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, had just resigned. And he turned to my wife when a man replaced Margaret Thatcher, John Major. And he said to my wife, was a man allowed to be prime minister? Because everybody in authority, his mum, the Queen, the prime minister, and the Speaker of the House of Commons, who he'd seen on the television, Betty Boothroyd, were all women. And it seemed inconceivable that a man should have any power.
That's a very interesting story. Continuing that line... Are you what could be called a monarchist?
Yes, I think that it is best for Britain to have a monarchy. I think the monarchy has served Britain very well, and I don't think a presidential system would work well here. That does not mean that I think that other states that have presidential systems should revert in some way to monarchies.
Understood. How would you rate the late Queen?
I think the late Queen was a very successful hereditary monarch. She was successful in all sorts of ways. First of all, basic necessity for a hereditary monarch, she guaranteed the succession. She had an heir and three spares, as we would say in Britain, which was absolutely crucial. Secondly, she was able to exercise her position without making monarchy a central feature of British political dissension. So there wasn't a republican movement with any significance other than in Northern Ireland, which is a separate history. And I think from that point of view, she was successful. And the grief, sadness, sense of passing that matches her departure reflects the extent to which she was variously respected, loved, and admired.
Did the Queen have the same exposure to state papers as her pater, King George VI, or for that matter, her grandfather, King George V? I seem to recall that while the Foreign Office distribution list had the palace listed under her father. In her reign, I do not recall that the palace was listed as on the Foreign Office distribution list.
Well, as with all of these matters, those are things that are confidential, and I wouldn't, and nor would anybody else, be in a position to tell you at the present moment. I think one could fairly say that the scale and burden of government and the is much greater. Ironically, Britain is a much less powerful state, but the scale and range of government is much greater. And quite frankly, there's a limit to which you would want anybody to be sent state papers. I think it's reasonable to note that the Queen not only got a lot of state papers, but she was the only person that gets to meet regularly with the Prime Minister and on a one-to-one confidential basis. I mean, that's not true of any cabinet minister on that regularity. One other point I ought to make is when you asked me about monarchy, of course, what I was talking about was hereditary monarchy. I mean, you might argue that, in fact, a presidential system is simply that of an elective monarchy and has the strengths and weaknesses of an elective one as opposed to a hereditary one. An elective one means that the succession is less predictable. Nobody knows who will be elected president in the next American presidential election. In theory, it should mean that it is easier to call on the pool of talent in a society than if you have a hereditary one. And it also means that you deal with the issue of retirement more easily in the American situation by having a provision for a maximum of two terms for a president. I mean, part of the Queen's eventual success is that she was able to continue working until just before she died. So there wasn't a period of protracted ill health, physical, or as in the case of George III, mental, nor was there need to debate a regency or other such matters. So to that extent, chance played a large role in the Queen's, as it were, immediate reputation.
Yeah, I believe that the advantage, at least from my perspective, of a monarchical form of government as opposed to a Republican presidential one is that, at least in the American instance, the head of state is also the head of government, and that while there are some very few political figures who combine both roles well, it's a rather there are not many who do so.
Well, I think that's right. And in Britain, every time there is consideration in conversation or on the media about who might be a president or who might be candidates for a presidency, they are inevitably contentious. And I think it's fair to say that that also serves as a warning to the hereditary monarchy that were they to be politically partisan, they would rapidly have their situation compromised in what is a country that has quite major political differences and divisions.
Why was the Queen so enamored of the Commonwealth, particularly considering the fact that such horrible characters as Idi Amin was associated with it?
Well, I think that's a very reasonable point. I mean, it is argued, of course, that the Commonwealth gives Britain and the British monarchy more particularly a continuing global role that it would not otherwise have. But you're absolutely right. And I've argued in my forthcoming book on the history of the British monarchy that actually in Britain itself, among the bulk of the population, interest in or support for the Commonwealth is rather limited. I mean, there tends to be individual countries that people can be sympathetic to. Australia is a good example, but not necessarily the whole of the Commonwealth.
Who would you surmise was her favorite prime minister?
She said her favorite prime minister was Sir Winston Churchill, and there's no reason to believe that wasn't the case. He played an important role, rather like Viscount Melbourne did with Queen Victoria, in helping a young woman to become able to do the role. He was a kind of father figure. He had a genuine sense of wit and humour, a strong sense of duty, and he also was, even though he was heading for, and in fact then experienced growing health problems, he also was, by all and any standard, the greatest peacetime and wartime Briton of his generation. So it would be difficult not to fall into admiration for him.
And who would you surmise would be her least favourite Prime Minister?
Oh, Tony Blair. Not so much. You know, people usually comment on the Princess Diana thing, where obviously he followed a rather headline-grabbing approach, but not so much for that. I think the Queen could see through that this was a man who was basically self-obsessed, who was fixated on trivia. I mean, for example, if you look at the television images of the Queen, I don't recall ever seeing her as unhappy as she was on the ludicrous opening of the Millennium Dome, with which Mr. Blair, of course, insisted on. And he repeatedly pushed through changes which the Scottish Assembly, the Welsh Assembly, the Scottish Parliament, which any fool could have said and pointed out had long-term consequences which were potentially very troublesome. So I think she could see through Blair, as unfortunately much of the electorate could not.
Would it be true to say that Her Majesty never went so far as to indicate a preference for a particular individual for a particular office, the way that her pater, His Majesty King George VI, it has been alleged, convinced Attlee not to name Hugh Dalton as Foreign Secretary, but instead Chancellor of the Exchequer?
Well, we don't know that she did, and there's no reason to believe that she did, but it would be foolish to imagine that issues did not crop up in conversation. And I imagine she would also have had views on who would be, for example, High Commissioner for Australia, which might well have been issues that themselves had a degree of significance. But yes, I mean, she was a much more cautious monarch than George VI, or even more George V. George V had played a very major role in British politics in the early 19-teens, and then again in 1931. And there is no evidence that the Queen played a comparable role when Britain was in crisis in the mid-1970s.
Why was Her Majesty so popular?
I think she became popular, or rather re-became popular. I don't think that her popularity was overwhelming in the 1990s. I think, you know, she'd been popular in the 1950s, in the new Elizabethan age, in an age where there was still a lot of deference and where she was a figure of considerable glamour. She became somewhat, as it were, to some people at any rate, of less relevance in the 1960s. I think what you've seen over the last 20 years is a recovery of her popularity, partly because of her own merits, people's awareness of her sense of duty and her basic decency, and partly also because other institutions have lost reputation. And that, again, I think is an important contrast.
How would you surmise His Royal Highness King Charles III will do as king?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously, the initial impressions have been positive. He's very much come across as somebody concerned to rule on the pattern of his mother, and issues that people have alleged about his earlier behaviour at a time, faddishness of some of his interests like homeopathy and a degree of petulance, are not to the fore. But I don't know. And I think he is in a very difficult position because by the very nature of things, the United Kingdom is now a multipolar political system. And he is going to have to face the need to discuss matters with, shall we say, the Prime Minister when he might feel that there are very contrary views being held in, shall we say, possibly Scotland or Wales.
Professor Black, last word?
My last word is that the death of the Queen marks the end of a life of that was impressive both for what she did and for what she stood for. I think that she comes in the pattern of a number of other monarchs, George III, George V, George VI, very obviously, who had very strong senses of duty and commitment. She wasn't somebody who withdrew from the burdens, as Queen Victoria did for a while, nor was she somebody, as either George IV was or Edward VIII was, who had personal issues that made them in some respects unfit for their job. So I think she was very impressive. She became monarch in 1952, the very year, incidentally, in which yet another monarchy went, in the case of Egypt. During her lifetime, she became an important symbol and exemplified how constitutional monarchy can work effectively.
On that observation, which I would like to agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Black, for being so kind as to speak with us today. You've been listening to Arguing History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Black, very much.
Thank you very much indeed.